Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, University of Illinois historian and author Mary Frances Phillips talks about her biography, Black Panther Woman, The Political and Spiritual Life of Erica Huggins. It was published in January 2025 by New York University Press. So I asked Mary Phillips how her interest in Black Panther leader Erica Huggins developed.
My interest in the topic actually dates back to my undergraduate years. When I was an undergraduate at Michigan State University, I had what was then called a specialization in Black American and Diasporic Studies. And in my African American history courses, when we got to the topic of the Black Panthers, it was less on women in the movement, in particular the Black Panther Party, and more on men and this kind of masculinist orientation. And so I was very curious on who these women were, what were their contributions. And so I just kind of put that in the back of my mind. I went and did my master's at The Ohio State University. And then when I came back to Michigan State to do my PhD, and it was time for me to write my dissertation topic, I knew that I wanted to do women in the Black Panther Party. It started much broader, you know, with time and with research, shaped itself a little bit more specifically on women in the movement. Initially, my dissertation was a dual biography, and Erica Huggins was one of the subjects in that dissertation. But as I was working on that dissertation, initially, I had never heard of Erica Huggins. I didn't know who she was. And as I was presenting at conferences as a graduate student, I became part of a community meeting Panther scholars. And I got introduced to Erica Huggins, and we connected on the phone. And ever since then, we built a professional relationship. I was blown away by her story. There's so much about her story that is really rich, that is powerful, and it really tells a story of what Black Panther Party organizing looked like behind those prison walls.
What was the Black Panther Party all about, you know, in terms of what its focus was back in the 60s and 70s?
Yeah, so the Black Panther Party was all about political organizing in the particular sense that the organization was designed to meet the needs of Black and Brown folks, to meet the needs of oppressed people in the community. It was a grassroots political organization. They did this work in meeting the needs of the community through, which is, I consider, the bread and butter work of the organization, their community programs. So they had well over a dozen community programs. Most people have heard of their free breakfast program, but they had free health clinics. They had a free shoe program. They had free clothing program. They had the Oakland Community School. They had a program that was for senior citizens where they provided transportation to get their medications and what have you. I mean, there's so many community programs that the organization had, and they continually built those organizations to meet the needs of the community even as time progressed. So they're constantly addressing issues of poverty, addressing issues of racism, capitalism, all of these kinds of issues to serve our community.
And so what was Erica Huggins' role in the organization, and how does she get to be a political prisoner in the late 60s and into the 70s?
Erica Huggins joined the organization when she was a student at Lincoln University. She came across an article and a story, an image of Huey P. Newton, who was strapped to a hospital gurney at the time in Ramparts magazine while a student at Lincoln University. She was so moved by the story and the image that she decided to leave school with her partner at the time, John Huggins, drive all the way across country and join a Black Panther Party. She started at a rank and file level and she rose to the Central Committee. She worked for the Black Panther Party newspaper. She served as the director of the Black Panther Party's Oakland Community School, their last surviving community program. And how she became a political prisoner really had a lot to do with the FBI and COINTELPRO. So when she was doing her organizing work in the LA chapter, her partner, her husband at the time, John Huggins, along with Bunchy Carter, got murdered by the FBI on the campus of UCLA in 1969. And so after his murder, she buried his body in his hometown of New Haven, Connecticut. So she went to New Haven and community members came up to her and asked her if she would be open to starting a Black Panther Party.
But she wasn't from New Haven.
No, she's from Washington, D.C.
Okay.
The native of Washington, D.C. So she started a Black Panther Party chapter in New Haven, Connecticut. Not long after she did this, you had the FBI, you had COINTELPRO that was still tracking the organization, that was still tracking her. She got caught up in a whole FBI plot, and she ended up getting charged for murder, conspiracy, and kidnapping for a party member, Alex Rackley, for his death. And so that's what led her to prison. At the time, Erica referred to the prison as Niantic because it was in Niantic, Connecticut, but it's actually called today the Janet York Correctional Institution.
But it's a prison.
Oh, it's definitely a women's prison. Yes. And she was incarcerated for 2 years for that crime. She stood trial with Bobby Seale. They ended up having a mistrial. She got her freedom and she went straight back to work for the Black Panther Party when she got her freedom.
Wow. Well, early in your book, you talk about the relationship that you developed with Erica Huggins in terms of the research you had to, you know, embark on and the writing of the book. And that this was not typical, if there's such a thing as there's a typical way that a writer and his or her living subject should interact. So could you talk about what it was like working with Erica and how you got her to let you explore her spiritual, political, and even her personal life?
Well, it took multiple conversations with Erica to really finish this book because it's so many parts of Erica's life that is not recorded. Right. There's pieces of her life in various archives, but there's not like one location with all of her archives. And so at times I had to come to her for parts of her life and parts of her story that only she knew. I had also primary documents, for example, a lot of my prison documents, which included a log that correctional officers kept on her everyday movement and behavior while she was incarcerated. It was important to me to get her response to that log as well.
But how did you even get access to the log? Because, I mean, you know, most prisons don't say, oh, yeah, come on in.
Right.
And view this.
Yeah. Well, you know, I reached out to the prison board at the time through a lot of letters, follow-ups, what have you, because I actually did visit the prison that she was incarcerated at, her and the other Black Panther Party women she was incarcerated with. I actually went to the area where they believed that the Panther women were housed on those prison grounds as well. And then I worked with the prison staff. There's a whole archive unit that I work with to get that information. Erica actually had to sign off on me to get all that information. And so she signed off on it and I was able to access. And it's interesting because I had to request it from them several times because the first time I requested it, they didn't give me everything that was in her folder. So I was communicating with the Connecticut State Library and they would give me a sense of everything that was in her folder. And then when I would actually request it from the prison, they wouldn't give me everything. So I knew what was in it. So it took a lot of persistence to get as much as I could about her life. Mm-hmm. And that log really gives you a window into the kind of organizing work. It gives you a window into how the state perceived her. They perceived her as an agitator. You see the way in which they abused her. You can see the things that they blacked out to protect themselves. And so it tells its own story, but it's really informative. You also see her resistance as well. And there's times when I would talk to Erica, and she would say, "Oh no, I probably said that. That probably happened. No, that didn't happen. They're exaggerating that." And so it was interesting to write up from the perspective of the state and then push back against the state as well.
Okay. So now you have these official documents from the prison, but then you have to get up front and personal with Erica since she's living and, really vibrant and still here with us. How open was she to your interviewing and pulling out her personal experiences?
Well, it was a lot of negotiation. At times, there were some conflicts in my interpretation of her life as a professional historian and how she saw her life. And so there were some parts of her life that she asked me to cut out. And that was a discussion, right? For me, it was a delicate balance of negotiation. But she read just about every draft of the book. And it was mainly to fact check, particular moments, when you talk about your grandmother in this period, did I have this particular year right or what have you from your memories? But this is always in conversation with archival documents. Part of what we do as historians, we're placing it in a proper historical context as well. And so there is a steady negotiation with oral history and the archival documents. But it was certainly a kind of negotiation. There were some parts that I agreed to cut out because there were larger stakes involved, and so much of the past is still with her today. Lives are impacted even still today. And then with other parts, I felt like it should stay in the manuscript. And so it was a really delicate balance. Also, oftentimes I hear activists talk about, these academics come in, they do their research, and then they write their articles, and we never hear from them again. We don't even know if the book came out. And so for me, I wanted to make sure Erica knew what was going on and knew the process, knew where I was. So she always knew where the book was at as far as its standing throughout the whole process. So, yeah.
Okay, so you talk about oral histories. Did you get a chance to interview many of the people in her life, whether they were family members, former Panther members, colleagues? Did you expand your oral history interviews to the wider community around Huggins?
Absolutely. I had to because I really wanted an intimate portrait of Erica's life. I wanted to take my reader into that moment of time. So if I'm talking about 1970, when she started this multiracial organization with other imprisoned women, which she co-founded with a young Puerto Rican sister, Millie Rivera, I wanted to find Millie Rivera's family. Millie Rivera has since passed away, but I was able to talk to her daughter. I was able to talk to her brother and learn so much more about her and her particular life history as well, and so much work that she did when she got out of prison. So I really wanted to find the women that Erica was organizing with. There are some oral histories that's been published with some of the other Panther women that she was incarcerated with, so I was able to use that. I was able to talk with Angela Davis. I was able to talk with the prison warden. She was in her 90s at the time of our interview, but she was actually the warden when Erica was incarcerated. I was also able to talk to a correctional officer who actually was violent to Erica Huggins and the other Panther women that she was incarcerated with. So, hearing his story, hearing Erica talk about it, looking at how the Black Panther Party newspaper talked about it as well, using all of these sources. And so I also interviewed lawyers. One of the lawyers that Erica worked with, that was part of the team, as well as some of the lawyers that were working with some of the other women that were incarcerated. when Erica was incarcerated and doing that same kind of organizing work. And so there are a wealth of people. I talked to Erica's youngest son. There's a wealth of people that I talked to really get a broad range of history and experiences and memories about Erica Huggins. Not just
Right.
Erica Huggins, but the other women she organized with as well.
And speaking of organizing, you talk about her experience in prison and the fact that she's in her early 20s. She's a new mother. I mean, literally, her daughter was what, 2 or 3 months old when she was in prison. And yet she had the strength of character to, you know, resist the violence that she had to experience in prison and deal with a spiritual awakening. So could you talk about how she was able to keep herself grounded and connected with her fellow political prisoners?
It's really a remarkable story because she lived bigger than herself when she was incarcerated. I mean, when she was on trial, they were trying to give her the chair. And it takes a lot of inner work to do the kind of organizing that she did. So initially, she was in solitary confinement with the other Panther women. They kept them separated from the general population because everything they said was considered contraband. They was worried that they would start a riot or what have you. So they kept them separated. Erica knew that she needed to do the kind of internal work to help her survive the everyday trauma that she was experiencing when she was incarcerated. And so she turned to one of the lawyers on her team, Charles Gary, who was a yogi at the time. He would do headstands before he would go into court. And she turned to him and asked him for a book on yoga. And so he gave her one and she literally studied that book, right? She studied the images, she studied the words, and she self-taught herself yoga and meditation. And she would squeeze that in when she could. You know, when you're incarcerated, your time is not yours. And so oftentimes she would maybe have 30 minutes at most of time to herself. And so she would find a space within the small wing that she was incarcerated in and practice her poses and do her meditation. And she was in solitary confinement for almost a year. All the rest of the Panther women, you know, over time ended up being released. She ended up getting moved to the general population and she knew she had to extend that. So she started doing this kind of communal work with other women in the general population, starting a hair salon, starting a women's bail fund, all kinds of sorts, redesigning their prison uniforms. This was through the work of the Sister Love Collective. So she was extending those spiritual wellness, self-care practices. She was able to better serve the community because she had been taking care of herself. Now, part of the reason why she wanted to, when she was in solitary confinement, that she wanted to really turn to that spiritual work is because, you know, John Huggins' mother would bring her daughter to see her once a week on a Saturday for an hour. She didn't want her young daughter to see her broken, to see her sad, to see her depressed. She wanted to be fully present, fully engaged for her daughter. And so that's part of what helped sustain her. And through that practice, she learned not to take anything for granted. And so she was really conscious of how to balance her emotions and her emotional regulation, which is really important when you're in a hostile environment like prison.
You know, as a historian, how did you organize all the material and information that you gathered, both in terms of what was happening in the world, in the times that, you know, Erica was going through, not just prison, but, you know, in the Panther Party and beyond, as well as the primary and secondary sources that you had to, you know, use?
So I organized it by chapters, by topic, by subsections. At times I had to move stuff around, trying to figure out how I wanted to use the sources and what parts of her life were critical to bring out. You can't include everything. And so oftentimes keeping in mind your thesis as well. Also getting feedback helped from peers doing similar work as well. But I knew I wanted to organize it in a way that was chronological, offering a kind of texture of her life. So it starts from her childhood, her very early spiritual origins when she was a young girl, looking into the mirror, talking to her sister, thinking about or saying aloud, I see something deeper in my eyes. There's something deeper. So I wanted to start from her earliest origins of spirituality and carrying that forward to her life after she got her freedom and did her Black Panther Party organizing, in particular at the Black Panther Party's Oakland Community School. But the turning point of her spirituality, her spiritual wellness practices was in prison, really shaping her work in the Black Panther Party. Once she got out of prison, a lot of those spiritual practices she was doing in prison, she brought to the Black Panther Party's Oakland Community School and was, having the children learn meditation and yoga and these kind of wellness practices as well. And so there was small pockets of wellness, spiritual wellness practice that we see amongst activists. Stephanie Evans talks about Rosa Parks engaging in yoga and teaching yoga classes, right? Mutulu Shakur and the acupuncture and the Lincoln Detox Center that he was doing. So there's these small pockets of wellness practices happening, and Erica is very much in line with those particular practices. And this is a part of the Panthers' history that we oftentimes don't even think about. We don't think about spirituality when we think about the Black Panther Party or healing practices. For many people, this kind of masculine disorientation may come to mind with Black men in berets and in their uniform or what have you. What I offer is another version of what was going on in the Black Panther Party during this time.
Excellent. The other thing that's interesting about your book is that you take us from Erica's birth and childhood into her young adulthood. But after she leaves prison and you get into, what she did in the 70s, and then, of course, by the time the Panther Party declines and is, forced to disband, you don't necessarily bring us up to, say, 2024, 25. So one, what made you decide to essentially deal with this slice of her life as opposed to really trying to tackle her entire presence in the world to date?
Well, the heartbeat of the book is on her life in prison. Most people don't know what was happening behind those walls, and it offers us a story about women political prisoners, what Black Panther Party organizing looked like behind those prison walls. Oftentimes when folks are incarcerated, they place in these remote areas and it's almost like they're forgotten. And so the kind of revolutionary work that she was doing in prison is pretty remarkable. And it was such a pivotal period in her life. I mean, it was critical to who she is and who she became. And so that was important to me, to focus the bulk of the book on her prison activism in particular. And then I also wanted the book to be manageable for students to use in a classroom. I wanted my peers to be able to assign it in a classroom. For me, writing a 300-page book, I'm just throwing out, a page number, a 300-page book, for me, would make it very challenging for students to read it in the classroom. And so I felt like with the heartbeat of her life in prison really at the forefront of the book, and then talking about her activism in the Black Panther Party's Oakland Community School would give you a nice snapshot of the role of spirituality in her and other Panthers and other women in particular fighting back against the carceral state. It's really a conversation about carceral systems, about freedom making in the 1970s, in the 1960s. And I'm a scholar of that period, so I really wanted to stick with that period.
Do you have any recommendations for writers who might be interested in, in pursuing a similar kind of topic where they're looking at someone who is alive and well and still with us?
So I went to a lot of sources. I turned to novels. I turned to books that were, really foundational to book writing and the kind of academic work that doing. I turned to creative writing. I turned to poetry. I turned to literature. So it's hard to like suggest one particular source because I got my inspiration from so many different places because I really did not want to write the book in this kind of standard academic way. And what I mean, it's a lot of narratives in it, right? Because I really wanted my reader to really feel what Erica's experiences were. And so I went to a lot of different places for inspiration. So I'm struggling just trying to like suggest one. I also turned to autobiographies. Assata Shakur's autobiography was one that I think lended itself really nicely. It's more of an autobiography, but it really does the work that I think is very much in the spirit of Erica Huggins, as they were both Panther women. And I turned to Audre Lorde's work as well. I turned to Audre Lorde's poetry. That was really important. I turned to a lot of Black feminist writings. I remember looking at Beverly Guy Sheftall's collection on Words of Fire because it's such a Black feminist book. It's very much centered in the Black studies tradition as it really serves as a toolkit for students, for activists, for people interested in the field, for organizers out there. So those are some other sources that really kept me going.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. This has been wonderful.
That was historian and author Mary Frances Phillips speaking with me about her book, Black Panther Woman, The Political and Spiritual Life of Erica Huggins. It was published in January of this year by New York University Press, and this interview was recorded this month via Zoom. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Darren Neblett created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.